continue on this exciting sutta, the Satipatthana Sutta. And so we are looking at the introduction to the sutta. And as I said just 20 minutes ago, whenever it was, it starts off here with this idea that this is the direct path for the purification of beings. The word direct path here, this is one of these words that's very quite interesting in the Pali language, eka yana, which means something like eka is one, ayana is going, so it means one going path, eka yana mago, maga is path of course, there's a one going path, the path which goes in one direction only. This is kind of the idea here between the behind Satipatthana. So it goes in one direction only. I'm not sure about direct path because, there is only one path. It's called the Eightfold Path and there is no other path. So either it goes there or it doesn't go there. There's no such thing as a direct or in, kind of implies that there is an indirect path, right? But there's no indication in the sutta as that there is an indirect path. Either you're on the path or you're not on the path. That's really how it works. So I prefer the one path which goes in one way, one direction only, is probably one of the most accurate descriptions of that path. But there are some really people out there who are really like a bit controversial and have written long discourses about the meaning of Ekayana. And one of those people is my friend Adan Sujato. He's very prolific when it comes to writing things. And he wrote a book called The History of Mindfulness. And in the book, The History of Mindfulness, he has 10 pages, really dense pages, A4, but much very tiny print, right, on the meaning of the word ekayana. And he goes into the Upanishads, the ancient kind of Brahmanical teachings, and compares it to that and kind of brings out all these meanings. And he comes to the radical conclusion that ekayana means the path that goes to eka, goes to one, it goes to samadhi. Eka is the word for samadhi, right? That is kind of his conclusion there. That's pretty radical. I think he is probably the only person in the entire universe who says that. I've never heard anyone else come up with that conclusion before. But he likes to be a bit creative. And it's possible. It could actually mean that. It's not entirely wrong because eka, the idea of one, has this idea of samadhi. But I am not as daring as he is. I prefer more the path that goes in one direction only. That's my preference. That's what I think probably is the right one. Anyway. Yeah, the one and only path. But that's the Eightfold Path, right? The Eightfold Path is the one. It says, I know, but that's why that is a wrong translation, because it says in Dhammapada, es eramago nati anyo. This is the only path. There is no other. Which one? Eightfold Path, right? So this is only a small sub-aspect of the Noble Eightfold Path, and a sub-aspect cannot be the whole path in its own right, so that makes no sense. It is interesting because this word, ekayana, is also found in the sutta which comes just after this, Majjhima Nikaya 12, and there it says it is the path that leads to a cesspit. A man is being drawn towards a cesspit, and this is the path which goes in that direction only. It leads to the cesspit. It doesn't mean the one and only path to the cesspit. It means this goes in that direction only. Yeah. So I think it's fairly obvious that the one and only is a mistranslation of ekayana. So it goes path that goes in one direction only for the purification of beings. And this kind of adds again to this idea that the idea of Satipatthana is to first and foremost to purify yourself of those hindrances, right? First and foremost. And then ultimately also to purify yourself of all defilements of the mind, right? So there's a temporary purification that then takes you to samadhi, and ultimately the final purification that leads to the complete eradication of those things. And it is the main emphasis in Satipatthana is the purification that leads to samadhi. And the one that leads to the complete final eradication of hindrances is actually a secondary thing which comes afterwards. So this is that is the most important one. For surmounting sorrow and lamentation. And now, of course, we are talking about the final outcome of the path, for the disappearance of pain and grief. Again, the final outcome, arahantship, for the attainment of the true way. True way here is a word for nyaya in the Pali Suttas. Nyaya, it means like method or the kind of a way that things is done, the kind of procedure almost. And it is a meaning, it refers to dependent origination in the suttas. So for the attainment of the true way means for the understanding of dependent origination. If you want to understand dependent origination, you're supposed to practice Satipatthana. That's what it says there. And at what point do you understand dependent origination on the path? When you become a stream enterer. When you become a stream enterer, you get that insight into dependent origination. You understand how craving gives rise to suffering, gives rise to rebirth in the future. And then for the realization of Nibbana, and of course here for extinguishment, we are talking about the very last part, the very ultimate point again of the path. So in the end, in the ultimate sense, Satipatthana leads all the way to the end of the path, but still the primary purpose of it is to take you to Samadhi, and then after Samadhi, then that Satipatthana can take you also all the way to the end of the path. So you have to kind of think of Satipatthana in those terms of those two different functions. First and foremost to Samadhi, and then ultimately to the end of the path. So what are these four? And this is kind of the interesting summary of what Satipatthana is all about. Here, bhikkhus, a bhikkhu abides contemplating the body as a body, ardent, fully aware and mindful, having put away covetousness and grief for the world. So let's just stop there, because that already is a lot in there. I didn't actually talk about this to those who were, for all of you who were here at the beginning, but I think it's worthwhile repeating this, because this is kind of the core formula that describes what Satipatthana practice really is all about. So the words here are contemplating is anupassana, which means something like seeing along with. So contemplating is not a bad idea. The English word to contemplate can often mean just to observe or to look on something, to look onto. So here the idea of observing is really what is kind of at the front. You observe or you contemplate it. Both of those ways of looking at it are actually correct. Contemplating might actually be preferable. We'll see why in a second. So what you contemplate here, it says here, is the body as a body. And it's this kind of strange formulation, right? The Pali says, kaya kaya nupasi. And what it literally, if you're going to translate it literally, what it actually means is you contemplate a body in the body. It would be a more literal translation of kaya kaya nupasi. So the idea here, and to understand what this means, it is very often, again, very useful to remember the broader context and how these things are explained in the suttas. And one place where this is explained very nicely is in the Anapanasati Sutta, Majjhima Nikaya 118. And we'll have a look at that sutta later on. And in there it says, when you contemplate the breath, right, you are contemplating the body. Why? Because the breath is one body among bodies. Yeah, one body in the body, one body among bodies. That's what it says there. So the idea is that, and I think this is the right way of thinking about this, Satipatthana consists of a number of different ways of doing these practices. We will see in a second that it means you can look at the 31 parts of the body, you can do the four elements contemplation, you can watch the breath. These are different ways of doing the kaya nupassana. So what it means then, as far as I'm concerned, it means that you are focusing on one aspect of the body. Yeah, so he contemplating one aspect of the body. That is the right way of thinking about this. One body among bodies means that you're looking at one aspect of the overall context of what the body is about. And then I think you have an approximately right understanding of what is going on here. And we will see later on that that's exactly what we're doing. We're focusing on a certain way of looking at the physical body here. So again, you have to, sometimes you have to have quite a bit of broad knowledge of the suttas to be able to draw it all together like that. It's always very helpful. And it's not just monastics who have this kind of broad outlook. There are some lay people who have an amazing knowledge of the suttas, and sometimes you have to, they argue you down, and they kind of really really know more about you sometimes about the suttas than you do, which is actually very nice. It's nice that some lay people are so committed to studying these things. So you abide contemplating one aspect in the body. Ardent, this means energetic. The Pali word is atapi. It's very similar to the idea of virya, that you have energy in these things. It is a rather curious translation. The word ardent is not the word that people often use, but nevertheless, this is how they have chosen to translate it here. Fully aware, sampajano, same word as sampajanya, right? I talked about full awareness quite a bit before, the idea of purpose, the idea of suitability. So here the idea is that while you do your meditation, you have enough clarity in your mind to know that what you're doing is suitable. You're not going down the pathway of fantasy or of desire or whatever it is. You're staying with the meditation object. You know what's going on. You have sufficient clarity and sufficient mindfulness to know what's happening here. So full awareness, again, sampajanya is an important part of meditation practice as well. And then comes the interesting point, and this is that you have to be mindful, right? The important point here to understand is that all of these things that we are looking at now, ardent, fully aware, mindful, contemplating, all of these things is how we are supposed to do the Satipatthana practice. It describes how. These are like adjectives. And they explain how the practice is supposed to work. In other words, you have to be mindful to do this practice. It means that mindfulness has to be established already before you can actually do Satipatthana practice. Yeah, that is what this means. Sattima is the Pali word there. And this is why I think that the idea of the foundations of mindfulness is not a very good translation, because you're not actually creating mindfulness. You are using the mindfulness that has already been established through the other factors of the Noble Eightfold Path, and now you are using it to take it one step further, to go deeper in your meditation. So what does it mean to be mindful? This is kind of the important issue here, right? At what point have you got enough mindfulness in your meditation to know that you are mindful? This is kind of the crucial thing, because if you don't know what that means, you cannot really decide whether you are ready for watching the breath or whatever, because you don't really know what's going on. And the answer is that the general idea of mindfulness is that you are sitting back, you have a reasonable awareness of what is going on around you. The mind is not really dragged to the past or to the future very much by desires and ill will and these kind of things. You are basically in the present moment. Not completely, because there's always going to be a few thoughts going through the mind. It's not an absolute thing, but you're not kind of completely fantasizing away in some kind of faraway country. I know that some of you, did anyone even go to Japan recently, the Japan trip? Oh, that was okay. Sure, okay. That's very good. So you're not kind of in Japan, right? And kind of, you never really left that country, so you're kind of stuck there in a sense. You are actually back here in Malaysia now. And that is when you know. So this is the first aspect of mindfulness. You are in the present moment, rather than being carried away somewhere. And the second idea is that you have a certain amount of clarity about it. There are many ways of being in the present moment. You can be slothful and tired. You're not really thinking, but you're not really here either. You're kind of nowhere, right? So you are here, and you are here with a certain degree of clarity. And that is what it really means here, to be mindful. And when you have that state of mind, that is when you're ready to do Satipatthana practice. That's when you are ready to do mindfulness of breathing and these kind of things. Now, of course, these things are just words, and each one of us, we have to experience for ourselves what these mean in practice. And this is part, of course, of parcel of the meditation practice to learn about these things, to know when the mindfulness is deep enough and powerful enough to actually work in practice. Yeah? So each one of us, we have to learn that for ourselves. All I can do is give you a rough guidance, and then you have to try it out and check it out for yourself. So you have to be mindful already, and this is why the path is so long before we even get to mindfulness. This is why we have all of these things about right effort and right this and right that. All the six rightnesses that come before right mindfulness, because all of these things build up the possibility of then doing the mindfulness practice properly here. And then we have the next one, having put away covetousness and grief for the world. You remember that one? Huh? We've seen this one a couple of times already. Huh? There's been so many hours. If you don't remember it, I don't really blame you. But so this here, the Pali here is Vinaya Loki Abhidra Domanasa is the Pali behind this. And this is one of those phrases that actually is quite important to understand again how Satipatthana actually works. And the first thing to point out, which I pointed out before, is that covetousness and grief is an absolutely terrible translation in this particular context. Abhidra Domanasa means, I said before, it means desire and aversion. It means liking and disliking. And it refers to the objects of the five senses. That is what it referred to. So loke here, the word loke, which here is translated as world, has many different meanings in Pali, just as it has a large number of different meanings in English. Right? But here it seems to have that specific meaning, the world of the five senses. The things we see, the things we hear, the things we feel, etc. That is what refers to. And of course that is exactly where we tend to have desires and aversions. This is what we mean by sensual pleasures, right? Or sensory pleasures. That's exactly what it means. So when they translate as covetousness and grief, you have absolutely no idea that that's what it's supposed to mean, right? How can anybody guess that that's what it's supposed to mean from those words? You have to be able to read somebody's mind to understand that. And so if someone, you can read minds? No? 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 Sorry. Sixth sense. Yes, that is included as well. I thought you were going to say that I can read minds, but I... So, the sixth sense is... included in the sense that the sixth sense can take the objects of the other five senses, right? It's like when you dream, you can see things, you can even hear things and feel things in your dream. And when you fantasize, it's like you can see things. You're not actually seeing with the eye, you're seeing with the mind. So the mind has the ability to do what the other senses do. So you have to also abandon that desire that relates to those things, those mental things at the same time. Otherwise, you can get away with a lot of that dodgy things, right? If the mind is okay, because the mind can create all kinds of stuff. So the mind, but the mind is very multifaceted, and the mind can go beyond those things. And that is really the happiness of the mind, which goes beyond sensuality. That is the kind of mind you want. That's the pure happiness, the happiness of samadhi, the happiness of jhanas. So that's where we're trying to head. So, and I remember this, I think it's Ajahn Brahm who told me this. Ajahn Brahm, of all people, he said that I never understood that phrase, right? I could never understand it, so I kind of just didn't read it, what it actually means. And this was when he had been a monk for 20 years, until he started looking at these things carefully and the Pali and starting to understand what is going on. He had been a monk for 20 years. Right? One of the best meditators that I know of, Ajahn Brahm, he did not understand what this meant. That shows you how difficult it is to get it, right? It basically is impossible unless you carefully study these things and you pull out the meaning yourself. So that is why Bhikkhu Bodhi, generally very reliable, very good translator, but here he has gone badly astray. And... sometimes it's nice. Bhikkhu Bodhi is a very, very nice monk. I know him quite a bit because I communicate with people like Bhikkhu Bodhi. And I it's very nice because when he was translating the Anguttara Nikaya, I was sending him feedback on the translation because I was translating it as well. And he is a very open-minded person. So if you complain and say, this is a bad translation, if you have a good point, he will listen to you. Even though I am just this whippersnapper, right? This young little monk compared to him. He's like, how old is he compared? He's about 20 years older than me. And he is how many more years as a monk than me? Over 20 years more than me as a monk, right? And then I come around and say, listen, Bhante, this is no good. You've got to do it like this. Of sounding a bit arrogant, because that's what you do when you are kind of a young whippersnapper. And then he actually listens to what you have to say, right? He takes it on board. He's not kind of defensive and doesn't want to look at it just because you are a young monk. He actually listens and takes it on board. And that, I think, is very impressive when you have so much seniority. Most people in that kind of position, they will just kind of brush you aside and say, okay, you don't know what you're talking about, so forget about that. That's usually how things work, right? So I must admit, I really respect him for that. But still, I also think it is important to point out weaknesses. And this is one of these weaknesses. I didn't have a chance to comment on these translations because they were done before I got into these things. This is an old translation going back to 1995. So I was just barely ordained at that time, so I didn't have any input in this. So it's not my fault, okay? Just to make that clear. So having put away aversion and desire for the things in the world of the five senses, or for the five senses, or for the objects of the five senses, this is what it means. And if you now think back, right, think back when we were looking at the sense restraint formula, if you think back to the sense restraint formula, it is very similar to this. What it says there is that you should not allow, and he uses exactly the same translation, covetousness and grief, and I said he should have used desire and aversion, right? He does not allow, he restrains the senses so that desire and aversion do not invade his mind. Remember that, the word invade, yeah? And I said invade, probably also not so good. It's like they arise in his mind. So now you can see the connection here. The connection is that in the sense restraint formula, you are using sense restraint to stop these things from invading the mind. When you do that successfully, that is when you move on to satipatthana. So that is why it says here, having put away, because you have successfully done that part already. Now you have put it away and you can move on. You can see the direct connection here between sense restraint on the one hand and satipatthana practice on the other. So you can see how integrated the suttas are. Everything is kind of, it takes probably a mind like a Buddha to be able to integrate the teaching in such a marvelous way. You can see the connections everywhere through the suttas in this way. So that is the kind of basic refrain there, how you contemplate the body, one particular aspect of the body. And that is how you do it. And then we will have a look later on at what kind of things that is contemplated in this way. Then we have exactly the same formula for the other satipatthanas, right? Yeah. Please ask if you wish. No problems. He abides contemplating feelings as feelings, ardent, fully aware, and mindful, having put away desire and aversion for the sensory objects. So here we have feelings as feelings. Again, it means one aspect of feelings. So he abides contemplating one aspect of feelings. Energetic, fully aware, mindful, having put away desire and aversion for the objects of the five senses. So here you have different types of feelings and you contemplate the feelings in different ways. And of course, this is quite interesting. What does it mean by contemplating feelings? Because there are many different ideas about that, but we will stick to what it says in this sutta afterwards, and we'll see what that actually means. He abides contemplating mind as mind, or you can say mind qualities as mind qualities. Ardent, fully aware, or energetic, fully aware, and mindful, having put away desire and aversion for the objects of the five senses. He abides contemplating mind objects as mind objects. And again, energetic, fully aware, mindful, having put away desire and aversion for the world of the five senses. So this is the one, the last one here, is probably the one that is most controversial. How should this be translated? This here is called the Dhamma Nupassana. Dhamma is to Dhamma Nupassana. And what is the meaning of Dhamma in this particular context? This is actually quite difficult to make out. And to really make this out, you have to study the sutta in a fair amount of detail. And I will actually tell you later on some of the conclusions of those people who have studied this sutta in much more detail than I have. And their conclusion is that Dhamma in this context means something like conditionality. Right? You contemplate the conditionality of things as conditionality, or certain aspects of conditionality. Principles is another way, but principles is kind of similar to conditionality. Conditionality can mean principle in certain contexts. And that is what they have decided is the meaning here. And I think that is a reasonable interpretation. But to understand how that's possible, you have to have a broader idea of Satipatthana to be able to see that. Anyway, that is the introductory statement. And that gives us the background, that gives us the basis on which these contemplations actually are done. Now we can move on to some of these contemplations. And you can see here that the only contemplations that I have talked about for the body is the contemplation of the 31 parts, and then the elements, right? And that's the only contemplation that I have included here. And maybe you think that I am a dodgy monk who has kind of excluded so many things. I'm kind of having some kind of agenda here, trying to change the suttas in kind of a certain way. So I have to explain to you why I have done this, because otherwise I'm not really doing my job properly here. Now, if you read this sutta in the full version, there's a large number of meditation exercises, meditation objects that you can take according to this sutta. And it starts off with the very first thing it has is mindfulness of breathing. Right? This is the first thing. But, and this is kind of the interesting part, it only has the very first part of what is the full description of mindfulness of breathing here. And what is interesting about mindfulness of breathing is that if you go to the Anapanasati Sutta, the Sutta on mindfulness of breathing, what it says there is that as you do the mindfulness of breathing, all the 16 steps, in the Anapanasati Sutta, as you do that, you are fulfilling Satipatthana. Right? Not only body Satipatthana, if it is placed under body contemplation, you would think that mindfulness of breathing only has to do with body contemplation. But no, it fulfills all the four Satipatthanas just by doing mindfulness of breathing. And this is a wonderful thing because it makes the idea of practicing Satipatthana so simple. It brings it down to one object you have to watch. You don't have to think about complicating things with a large number of objects. What should I do next? But that one object, mindfulness of breathing, is all you have to do all the way to the very end and completing the Satipatthana practice in that way. And for that reason, it is rather strange that it is actually included in here the Kaya Nupassana practice, because it does not really belong as body contemplation. It belongs in the entire Satipatthana Sutta, under feelings, under citta, under Dhamma, all the way to the end. So for that reason, it is slightly dubious. Why is it only under the Kaya Nupassana? So what we have to do then, and this is what some of those people have studied this sutta as in great detail. I was mentioning Ajahn Sujato before, who did a very big study called The History of Mindfulness. But also people like Venerable Analayo has also done a study of this in quite a bit of detail. And what they do, one of the interesting things that I've already touched on a little bit, to get to the bottom of what is going on, is to compare the Satipatthana Sutta in the Pali with all other versions that exist of the Satipatthana Sutta. Because, as I have said before, These suttas were transmitted in different lineages, in different schools, over a long, long period of time. And during this process, they were translated into Chinese, right? And we're talking a bit about the Chinese Agamas already. Some of them were translated into Tibetan when Buddhism eventually went to Tibet. That was much later on, went to China first, which is kind of strange because geographically, Tibet is closer to India than China is normally, right? So, but because of all the mountains, they had to kind of come the long way around. Anyway, that's like being a bit sidetracked now. And then, of course, it was translated into many other languages as well, because it was a very large region that the Buddhist teaching spread out to. All of Central Asia. And Central Asia had a large number of different languages that were in use. Languages you have never heard about before. Right? Languages like Khotanese. Have you ever heard about Khotanese before? You have? Whoa, okay, there's one over there. Heard about Khotanese. That's great. What about Sogdian? Have you heard about Sogdian before? So these are the kind of languages. Languages that don't exist anymore. They died out about 1,000 years ago, and they're only found in these ancient manuscripts, buried somewhere in the desert, right? Somebody brings it out, and it's all this random scribbling, they have no idea what it is, can't even read it because it's some ancient dead language. And then it gets deciphered by scholars. And the scholars are really excited about this, right? This is what people love to do. It's like a puzzle trying to figure out what's written on these documents. So, for that reason, we have these suttas in many different versions. And I think there is about 7 different versions of the Satipatthana Sutta, if you include all the existing versions. And then when you compare the suttas, what you do, the idea is that the differences between the suttas, if they have a lot of differences, then that does not belong to the common core, which is likely to have gone back from the very beginning. And if there's only one sutta who has a certain aspect, it is unlikely that that belongs to the earliest teaching. Right? This is one way of deciding. There are other ways as well. This is not always 100% reliable, of course. Nothing ever is 100% reliable. That's just life. But it gives you one method by which to decide where the suttas, what is the core aspect of these suttas. And when you do that, what you find out is that the most important part of the Kaya Nupassana practice, apart from Anapanasati, because that has already, I've already mentioned why that is so important, is the 31 parts of the body. That is number one. It's found everywhere, absolutely everywhere. And because it is found in every recension of the Satipatthana Sutta, it must be the most important one, the one which goes back the most to the most earliest time of Buddhism. And the reason why I have included the four element contemplation is that the four elements too are very common. There's only one or two of the Satipatthana Suttas it is not found in, but it's found in all the other traditions. So because of that, that too is quite likely to be very early and perhaps original, perhaps going all the way back to the time of the Buddha himself. Yeah, so this is the way I go about this. I haven't done this research myself. I cannot read Chinese. I would love to be able to read ancient Chinese. It would be really good. Those scholars who are really good. Anyone here who can read ancient Chinese? Yeah? Wei Yin, can you read ancient Chinese? No? Okay. Yeah. Okay, so some people can, and you have to be a specialist because characters were used slightly different at that time and all of these kind of things. So you have to be a specialist to do this. But the really good scholars around, they can read ancient Chinese, Sanskrit, Pali, Tibetan often as well, right? So they have access to this really broad category of teachings. And they are the ones who do these kind of studies. So that is how I have chosen these two particular categories. A lot of background, just to explain you some very very basic things. And now that we have arrived at what is the core part of the teaching, let us talk about those core aspects of the teachings and see what they actually is about. So 31 parts of the body, right? This is how you do the contemplation of the 31 parts of the body. Again, bhikkhus, a bhikkhu reviews this same body up from the soles of the feet and down from the top of the hair, bounded by skin as full of many kinds of impurity. Thus, in this body there are head hairs, body hairs, nails, teeth, skin, flesh, sinews, bones, bone marrow, kidneys, heart, liver, diaphragm, spleen, lungs, intestines, mesentery, contents of the stomach, feces, bile, phlegm, pus, blood, sweat, fat, tears, grease, spittle, snot, oil of the joints, and urine. Just as though there were a bag with an opening at both ends full of many sorts of grain, such as hill rice, red rice, beans, peas, millet, and white rice, and a man with good eyes were to open it and review it thus. This is hill rice, this is red rice, these are beans, these are peas, this is millet, this is white rice. So too, a bhikkhu reviews this same body as full of many kinds of impurities thus, and then listing all the 31 parts again. So that is how you do this kind of contemplation, right? What is the point of this kind of contemplation? And the idea, the point is to kind of see the other aspect of the body, not see the body as beautiful and something attractive necessarily, but to neutralize some of that. The purpose is not to hate the body. The purpose is not to end up committing suicide, right? Because the body is so terrible. Actually, this is one of those amazing stories in the Vinaya to Parajika 1. I can't remember if I mentioned this already. To one of the Parajika rules in the Vinaya. The Parajika rules are the rules that lead to disrobal for the monastics. And in one of those rules, the rule on killing others, there is a story where the Buddha teaches this kind of contemplation. This is called the Asubha contemplation, the contemplation of the non-beautiful. And then the Buddha goes on retreat after teaching this. And when it comes out afterwards, the Sangha is so diminished. Right? And why is the Sangha so diminished? Because they were contemplating the 31 parts of the body. And they were so disgusted with their body that some of the monks decided to kill themselves. They couldn't bear it anymore. That is one of those very strange stories that you find in the Vinaya Pitaka. And then the Buddha, what did he teach after that? Anapanasati, mindfulness of breathing. Try this one instead, because we cannot afford to lose so many monks in the Sangha. So that is what happened, right? So because of that, this kind of practice can have some very serious consequences. I would normally not recommend this kind of practice to lay people, unless you are incredibly committed to the path, and it can perhaps be useful to kind of detach a little bit from the body, especially if you are single, living by yourself, just doing your own practice. In that sort of situation, you come out kind of almost like a monastic already. In that kind of situation, it might be useful. But generally speaking, I wouldn't recommend that, because in the pull between sensuality and the pull between giving up sensuality, there's a tension between those two. And if you live with one foot in the sensual world and one foot in the world trying to give it up, the sensual world is always going to win. Right? Why? Because at the very least it feels happy, right? Okay, I'm enjoying myself. But this other thing which you're trying to do, it kind of feels, 31 parts of the body is not very happy. Unless it takes you all the way to samadhi, then it will be happy. But prior to that, it's kind of a tug of war, and the sensuality is always going to win out. So unless you are really, really, really committed, I would not recommend this kind of practice. But sometimes, if you wish, you can try it out. So how is it done? And the point here is that you review this same body. This means your body. Always focus on one's own body. This is kind of the point here. So you focus on your own body and you see, you review it. It's like you imagine all of these kind of things, right? Okay, kidneys, right? Stomach or heart, or I'm not even sure where all these things are, but kind of rough idea where they are. And then you imagine these things, and sometimes you can use like a picture of the body if you're not sure where things are, and get some idea where all these things are. And as you imagine these things, see all of these things inside of you, the body doesn't seem so beautiful anymore, right? The body without the skin is not kind of the same thing. body without the skin, it kind of loses some of its attractiveness. The skin is really what makes the body attractive. Once you strip off all the skin, it's like, I don't know, it's kind of repulsive almost sometimes. I don't know if you have been to one of these famous German, he's kind of an artist, but he has this exhibition called The Body Worlds. Did he have that here as well? Yeah? Didn't have it here. What? Same pictures of it, okay. We had it in Australia. I came to Australia and showed these things. So you walk inside and you see all these bodies, and they have been kept by using silicon. Somehow he is able to keep this body in such a way they don't rot, right? He has, what did he call it? There was a name, plastination, I think he calls it. So he plasticizes the body by somehow injecting silicon or something into the body, and the body is kept for years afterwards without deteriorating at all. And he strips off all the skin, right? And you get to see what the body looks like. And I can tell you, it does not look quite as attractive without skin. Without skin, it's a different story. So, and this is what we're trying to do here, is trying to see the body from a different angle, right? To neutralize some of the desire and attachment that we have from the body. Not going so far as those monks who committed suicide, but kind of finding that midway house whereby the attachment and the desire goes down, but you don't feel horrified by the body. It's about neutralizing things. That's the purpose of this. And always with these things, you always start off with your own body. And the purpose here really comes out quite nicely when you see the simile here. The simile with the bag, right, which is full of hill rice, red rice, beans, and all these kind of things. So this, of course, is not disgusting. This is just things that are there, right? It's just a kind of a neutral view. Okay, these kind of things in there. So this is the final idea here, is not to be disgusted by it, but see it for what it is. And many of these things, when you get used to the idea of, you know, the intestines, they're not really necessarily ugly, they're just functional. They have their function, they do what they have to do, and that's really the purpose of these things. So it's a neutral view is what really is the idea here of this kind of contemplation. And then once you have contemplated this on yourself, that is when you can move on to other people afterwards. And then you get this universal feeling that all bodies are the same. All bodies are like this. So, So again, I wouldn't really recommend. I know that there are some teachers who recommend this kind of practice. I wouldn't really recommend it all that much, to be honest with you. I'm into having a good time. I'm just an Ajahn Brahm disciple, right? So I like to have a good time in the monastic life. I don't want to kind of end up with all kind of the wrong ways. And the strange thing is that often, if you do these kind of practices too much, and I know some monastics who have done that, they are sometimes the monastics who end up disrobing. Right? These things are supposed to stop your desire for the body, stop the kind of the all of this attachment to these things. And of course, that of course includes the opposite gender at the same time, right? To stop all of that. But because you are repressing too much, you're forcing it down, it's not really coming naturally. Because of that, it kind of, as soon as you stop doing that, everything just pops up back again, and it doesn't really work. And this, I think, is part of the problem. You don't actually, sometimes it doesn't actually work, and instead it just becomes a very hard and very difficult and very miserable monastic life, right? It's difficult enough already to be a monk. You're giving up many things in this world, right? And then you're carrying on with these kind of things just to add misery on misery. Oh, then no wonder you end up disrobing eventually. Give me a little bit of happiness at least. So, and I prefer Ajahn Brahm's way. Happiness upon happiness upon happiness. That's why I'm very happy to be Ajahn Brahm's disciple. So, that is the 31 parts of the body. And the way to do this again is just imagination. You don't actually need to see these things in real life, but just imagining what is going on is plenty good enough. Okay, now we come to the next little paragraph. And this is the paragraph that is headed by insight. So where do you think that little word insight comes from? Do you think the Buddha said that, or do you think somebody else said that? You don't get any prize for guessing this one, do you? It's just too obvious. Buddha didn't use parentheses, right? So because the Buddha didn't use parentheses, it must be somebody else who added that afterwards. And this, again, is one of those things that you often see in these kind of manuscripts, that the translators, they add little things. They want to help you, to make things more easy for you. So they add little things to kind of explain what is going on. And what happens is that, and this I've seen this happening myself, is that as time goes by, the parentheses start to disappear, right? And when the parentheses start to disappear, then it kind of falls in line with the rest of the text, and nobody is able to tell anymore that this actually was added by a translator later on. This is so typical. This is how changes happen. Nobody is trying to be evil. Nobody is trying to distort the word of the Buddha. Everybody wants to do what is right. Everybody wants to conserve these things to the best of their ability. But sometimes they go a bit overboard in their being too zealous in trying to conserve things. And by trying to conserve in the wrong way, you end up distorting in the long run. So yeah, I'm not really criticizing anyone, because everybody is actually trying their best. But sometimes when we try to do our best, even that actually can distort the message. The suttas are actually remarkably well kept intact, considering how long it is since the time of the Buddha. And that, of course, is a lot of merit and a lot of good work on part of the Sangha. But still, there is always little things like that that have kind of crept in and changed things over time. For example, the heading, the name of the sutta as well, that also is something that has been added later on, right? There was no name on the sutta originally. The little thing at the beginning, thus have I heard, that was also added later on, right? The Buddha didn't say, thus have I heard. Later generations said that. On one occasion, the Blessed One was living in Kuru. That wasn't said by the Buddha. That too has been added. So when you look at things like that, it is only the main message from the Buddha that really is original, if you like. Yeah? Really original, if you want to go back far enough. So, insight, it says here. Forget about that word insight. I left it in there on purpose, just so I could criticize it, right? So I'm being very naughty, but that is the reason. So let's see what it has to say. In this way, he abides contemplating an aspect of the body internally, or he abides contemplating an aspect of the body externally, or he abides contemplating an aspect of the body both internally and externally. Or else he abides contemplating in the body its nature of arising, or he abides contemplating in the body its nature of vanishing, or he abides contemplating in the body its nature of both arising and vanishing. Or else mindfulness that there is body is simply established in him to the extent necessary for bare knowledge and awareness. And he abides independent, not clinging to anything in the world. This is how a bhikkhu abides contemplating an aspect of the body. So here we have this long passage on how we are supposed to do the contemplation, right? The various ways, the various kind of attitudes we are supposed to have towards the contemplation. How much of this, if we do the comparative study I was talking about before, what is the most original part of this long refrain? Is everything original, or is only certain aspects of it that are original? And the most original part of this, the most ancient one, which seems to exist across all traditions, is the very first sentence. In this way, he abides contemplating eternally, externally, and both internally and externally. And the most of the rest of this seems to be later. There are some aspects towards the very end that are found in a fair number of versions, and for that reason, perhaps, is early on. But the middle part there about the arising and passing away, actually, that is likely to be the least original of this particular sutta. So let us then look at this first one. He abides contemplating an aspect of the body internally. Internally is ajata, it means relating to oneself, right? So it means your own body. It doesn't mean inside your body, it just means relating to yourself. And this is the idea of always starting with yourself when you do this. And what is interesting about this, if there is another sutta in the Digha Nikaya, I think it's called the Janavasabha Sutta, and in there, this idea of abiding, contemplating things internally in this way is related directly to samadhi practice. When you do this, when you contemplate an aspect of the body internally, it leads directly to samadhi afterwards, according to that sutta. Right? And that's exactly what I was talking about before. The idea that satipatthana is always the thing that leads to samadhi in the suttas. You start with right effort, then you have satipatthana, then you have sammasamadhi as a consequence. And here it relates the internal contemplation directly to samadhi. When you do the internal contemplation in the right way, samadhi is the result of that. You overcome that attachment to the body, overcome that hindrance of and then you move on from there. And then you abide, the next one is you abide contemplating an aspect of the body outside, externally, bahidda, that is other people's bodies, right? You start to realize that it's not just your body which is like this, everybody's body is like this. And that too can then lead you towards samadhi as a consequence. And then the final step is abiding both internally and externally, both your own body and the body of others. And the idea behind this is that there comes a point when you realize that all bodies are like this. Your body, the bodies of others, this is a universal phenomenon that is inescapable. Right? It doesn't matter where you get reborn. It doesn't matter what happens to you. Eventually, everyone is going to have a body like this. Okay, you might go to Devaloka for a while, right? And they kind of hang out there, and the body will be slightly different. But in the end, all human bodies, and you have to come back to the human realm or the animal realm or whatever, it will have this kind of composition, roughly. So it is a universal phenomenon. It's not something that you can escape. And it is when we understand that things are universal, it is at that point that we often make the breakthrough to things like stream entry and become actually awakened to what the Dhamma is all about. This idea of understanding that there is no escape from these things. Right? When you understand dukkha in its fullest context, going across everywhere, that is when you actually make the breakthroughs to these profound insights that are available on the Buddhist path. Start with yourself, then see the same thing is true for the others, and finally universalize. This is true everywhere, regardless of where you go. Okay, so I think I will stop there. We're getting close to the time. Does anyone have anything they want to comment on or ask about regarding this? Satipatthana Sutta. Everybody very happy with this? Are you going to start doing the body contemplation now? Okay, there you are. Okay.
Is there any difference between the word awareness and mindfulness?
Okay. So is there any difference between the words awareness and mindfulness? I think these are, in the Pali language, I think what you have to do is always you have to go back to the Pali to be able to really make heads or tails out of this. And in this case, the word awareness is sampajanya and mindfulness is sati, right? So you have to go back to the Pali and ask, is there any distinction between sati and sampajanya? And as I was saying before, sampajanya, which is here translated as full awareness, is all about understanding the purpose and the suitability of what we are doing. Sati is just the basic ability to be aware, to stay in the present moment and to be aware of what is going in. Which word we choose in English to represent these things is actually fairly random, to be honest with you. Sati, you can translate sati with mindfulness if you want. You could translate sati with awareness. You could perhaps even translate sati perhaps even with attention, right? You're attending in the present moment. The English words we use is quite flexible. So in English, I don't know, is there a difference between mindfulness and awareness? There probably is, but you probably have to go to the Oxford Dictionary to figure it out, because English language is so complicated, so many different, you know, varieties and how the words are used and all of that. So that's why it's so useful to stick to the Pali rather than to stick to the English translations instead. Yes. Yes. Sweet.
Jen, is it 32 parts of the body or 31 parts of the body?
Okay, so this is a good point. This in the suttas it's 31. In the Visuddhimagga, 32 parts. In the Visuddhimagga, they add the brain. That's right. Yeah, that's the difference. Yeah. Otherwise, it's the same thing. Yeah. Yes, over here. Yeah.
Ajahn, how can we be sure that what is stated in all the suttas are the actual word or the original word of the Buddha?
Okay.
Because you say that it's been recited so that it can be passed down.
Yep.
It's just like Chinese whisperer. By the end of the day, the line tends to get lost.
It's a very important question and a very good one to ask, because it's the kind of question that many Buddhists never ask. They just assume that you have the Pali Canon and everything must be the word of the Buddha. This is kind of the traditional assumption about these things. And it's way, way too simplistic an assumption to think like that. So the only way to really find out is to do things like comparative study, compare the Pali with the Chinese translation. The interesting thing here to understand what is going on is to understand that the translation of most of the suttas into Chinese, they come from the Sarvastivadin school of Buddhism. It's a different school of Buddhism than the Theravadin school. This school of Buddhism was in the north of India. Theravadin school was in Sri Lanka in the south. They were 3,000 kilometers apart. North to India to the south of India is a long, long, long distance. So, and that separation into Theravada and Sarvastivada happened around the time of Ashoka. If you read the Ashokan inscription, it talks about sending out messengers. And if you read some of the, compare that to some of the stories you find in the Samantabhasarika, one of the commentaries in the Pali Canon, some of the inscriptions you find in India, and you compare all of this, it seems quite likely that that is when this spreading out happened. Right? So it means that those suttas that were kept in the Sarvastivadin tradition and those that were kept in the Theravadin tradition, they have been apart since the time of Ashoka, because that's when they spread out. So that's 2,300 years. That was the time of Ashoka. It was about 2,300 years ago now. And yet, when you compare those suttas today, Sarvastivadin and the Theravadin ones, you compare them today, they are almost exactly the same after 2,300 years. There are small differences, and what I'm pointing out now is the differences in the Satipatthana Sutta. Satipatthana Sutta is one of the suttas with the most differences. It is actually one of the suttas that is the least reliable of all in the Pali Canon. It's quite astonishing. Nobody is really aware of that. But most of the suttas are actually very similar across the board. And that's how we can know with a fair amount of certainty that the core teaching of the Buddha is still the same today as it was all the way back to the Buddha. If it is the same after 2,300 years, there's only another 150 years or so, and then you go back to the time of the Buddha. So if we have been able to conserve them for 2,300 years, right, then surely we were also able to conserve them for the 150 years before that. It seems like a very reasonable assumption as far as I can see here. So this is how you can have some feeling for these things. There are also many other things as well. And that is that things like the suttas do not contain many things that you would expect them to contain if they were changed. There's no mention of Ashoka, for example, in the suttas. Ashoka was one of the big patrons of Buddhism in India. If anything had to be changed, the Buddhists were very proud of Ashoka, right? The biggest emperor in the history of India was a Buddhist. And they converted to him. He converted to that one. So, and later on, there were all these stories written about Ashoka. The Buddhists were very keen on the idea of having an emperor who was Buddhist. But it never made their way into the suttas. The suttas were closed down. They weren't allowed to add things into the suttas later on. Not just Ashoka, but even earlier events prior to Ashoka. Ashoka's grandfather, Chandragupta, the dynasty prior to that, the first historical dynasty in India, the Nanda dynasty. None of these things are mentioned in the suttas. The suttas were closed down very soon after the Buddha without adding all of these later things. So these are the kind of things that you use to decide whether, you know, how ancient the suttas are or whether they really come from the Buddha or not. If you wish, there is a nice little booklet called The Authenticity of the Early Buddhist Texts, right? I am the co-author of that booklet. So you can check it up online, Authenticity of the Early Buddhist Texts, and see what you think of that. It was published with the Oxford Center for Buddhist Studies. It was quite nice, and have a look at that one. And it gives many more arguments about these things and why they are authentic or not. Anyway, if you have any more questions, please, we'll take those later on afterwards. Let's have another break, and we'll see you again 4:45.